Street begins today with our monthly Philosophical Currents segment, where we take a deeper look at the ideas behind the news. Joining me is my friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, a podcast and radio show that we air monthly here at Prairie Public. And today we're exploring happiness and asking if it can be learned or shared across cultures. Why this topic? I noticed that Finland had just been named the happiest place on earth yet again, and that makes several years in a row the Finns top the world in how satisfied they are with their lives. So what's their secret? Is it something in the Finnish way of life, their social policies, or maybe even their state of mind? And importantly for today, can happiness be taught or transferred from one culture to another? I often wonder whether being happy is more about adding joy to our lives or taking things away that make us unhappy. And Finland, it seems to me, we're going to learn more about this, seems to excel at the latter. They have very few people living in misery or extreme unhappiness, thanks in part to strong social support systems. Does that mean the key to a happy society is reducing suffering rather than chasing bigger highs? Or do we need a mix of both less pain and more pleasure? We'll discuss these questions today. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
Happy to be here. You've set quite an agenda for us in our little conversation.
Well, I'm glad you are happy to be here, Jack. Finland, as I noted, keeps ranking as the world's happiest country. Why do you think that is?
You know, it's very interesting because there is always a slew of these articles every year when Finland is announced number one. They're always written in this sort of wry, jokey tone. And in the background, there's some suggestions. And in the foreground are always silly things like the article you shared with me. The guy was learning how to make bird boxes and stuff. Not that that's a bad thing, but I'm not sure that that makes you happy. And also, I've spent a bunch of time in Finland, although not recently. I used to teach graduate seminars at the University of Helsinki. I went to the University of Oulu to do some lectures. I really like Finland, and I have some Finnish friends, and I actually miss it. I'd like to go back. But Finland is full of contradictions, because on the one hand, it consistently is number one in this World Happiness Report. On the other hand, historically, it has a very high suicide rate, although they've done a really good job of cutting that down in the last few years, also has a fairly high alcoholism rate. The winters are very long. It's pretty similar to North Dakota in that respect, although they get more snow. And a friend of mine from Finland actually said that the snow is really a wonderful thing because it makes the nights and the days lighter. That you know, they have darkness for 12 hours a day, right? They're in Oulu. It's very, very far north. So the snow is a necessity. So on the one hand, you have this description of them as a very, very happy society, and as individuals is very, very happy. And on the other hand, you have these complexities and these contradictions. And what does it mean? And so I guess there are two basic questions that we have to ask. The first is, what do we mean by happiness and how do we experience it? And the second is it measurable? Is it quantifiable? How do we study happiness in a way that gives us information? And both of those are on the table in this conversation.
Let's take the first question first. What is happiness? And is it a matter of less suffering, more joy? And I think about the sitcom Friends. They have these Friends moments all the time. You know, they're always generally happy, adding joy to their life, maybe a little less suffering too. Which is most important relative to happiness?
So this is one of those questions that has actually haunted the history of philosophy. The study of happiness has been around almost as long as we have documentation of Western philosophy. And the person who really is the foundation of these discussions is Aristotle, who lived about 2,400 years ago. But interestingly is the Epicurean discussion, because when they first defined happiness, they defined it as the absence of suffering, which is what you're describing. But what's the absence of suffering? Death. So Epicureanism started to advocate for suicide because it would be the happiest state. So they refined the definition to make pain the absence of pleasure, as opposed to pleasure the absence of pain. And what I did there, by the way, was a little sleight of hand, which is I substituted the word pleasure for happiness. And one of the things that Aristotle tells us, and one of the things that has guided this discussion, is that happiness and pleasure are not the same thing. Pleasure, joy, contentment, these are terms that describe feelings. They're terms that describe a particular experience. But happiness is something longer. Happiness is something over time. One swallow does not make a spring, to misquote the phrase. So I'll give you an example that I often present to my students. Imagine you are a new mother. This would be harder for you and me than some of our audiences, but imagine you are a new mother and it's 2 weeks into having a child and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you are holding your newborn as she breastfeeds. And you are exhausted and you're overwhelmed and you're terrified and your body hurts and is sore from the breastfeeding and you're just completely just overwhelmed by the whole thing. Many mothers will describe that instance as one of the happiest moments in their lives. Now, how do you reconcile those two things? How do you reconcile the fact that you are in pain and overwhelmed with this sense of overwhelming happiness and overwhelming joy? And so what that suggests is that happiness is much more about meaning. It's much more about long-term goals. It's much more about the process that we engage in. And again, following Aristotle, the way that I always summarize it to my students is happiness is a doing, not a feeling. Happiness is an activity as opposed to a state of mind. And that changes the conversation completely.
But eliminating the negatives, the bad stuff in our lives over an extended period of time, and increasing, if we can, those things that make us pleasure, that we find pleasure in, must equate to better odds of being happy. Would you agree?
Almost certainly. And one of the things that the Finland discussion brings out that Aristotle does not talk about as explicitly because it wasn't a pre-modern idea is the fact that the structure and the institutions that we live in set the foundation for happiness. No matter how optimistic of a human being you are, you can't be happy in Gaza right now, right? No matter how optimistic you are, it's very, very hard to be happy in extreme poverty or insecurity. And so one of the things that underlies the Finland discussion is the fact that Finns are very secure in their healthcare. Finns are very secure in their education. Finns are very secure in their public safety. Finns trust one another. Social trust is tremendously important in terms of happiness. Finns have a reasonable, skeptical, but satisfying relationship with their government, although obviously that, you know, ebbs and flows with politics. I think about what's on my mind right now. Right? And I think about the things that prevent me from being happy. And one of them is the university and professors are under attack politically right now. And anything I can say can be used against me. That makes my life precarious. That makes me unhappy. The healthcare system is not particularly good. And although I have good health insurance, at any point I could reach the end of that, or an accident or cancer could mean bankruptcy. You know, that makes things precarious. I worry about drunk drivers. I worry about school shootings. I worry about all of these different things. And so every one of us has these circumstances that we face. And so the question is, do we feel safe or protected enough from these accidents of life, from these insecurities, that we can focus on other things? Can we focus on our relationships? I have someone very close to me who has just finished cancer treatment, and I'm very worried that it will be, you know, unsuccessful, but also the experience of the treatment was really terrible for him. That preoccupies me. I think about it all of the time. So how do I work on my intimate relationships? How do I work on my relationship with my wife? How do I preserve my relationship with my daughter, who is now studying abroad in Italy and feels very, very far away? How do I make time for friends? How do I take care of myself when I am worried about all of these things? So all of this is to say, you're absolutely right that despite what the Epicureans say, the absence of pain or the absence of, I'll say, threat or vulnerability is a precondition for happiness. And Finns don't feel vulnerable in the way that Americans do. And they certainly don't have that experience every day, every hour. Most people in the world, when they drop their kids off at school, don't have that moment that all American parents have as they're driving or walking away, which is, am I going to see my child again? It's very, very hard to be happy in that context.
So there are deep cultural factors then that make, and I'm using air quotes, Finnish happiness maybe unique to the Nordic context. Perhaps there are other cultures that excel as well. But then can we, as I asked in my introduction, can happiness, the culture, be copied? Can it be exported? Why wouldn't everyone want to dwell on how to make us all happier?
Well, I'm going to offer two different paths for that conversation, one that I'll reject and one that I'll follow through. The first one that I'll reject is, I don't know. Why don't people want to make the government protection stronger? Why don't we want to improve our healthcare system? Why don't we want better education? That's a political conversation, right? And that ends up being partisan and it has economic interpretations and all that sort of stuff. So I want to put that question aside. But there is a deeper question, again, that stems from early Greek philosophical discussion, and this is how they frame it, and I'll explain what this means. The question is, can virtue be taught? And what the question means is, can you teach someone to be ethical, or is it something that they have to practice, habituate, become a part of their life, much in the way that learning a second language becomes an intimate experience over a very long period of time. Now, why is that relevant? Because happiness has always been a part of the conversation of ethics in philosophy. Happiness is a moral question. We want to be happy because we think it's the good life. We want to be happy because it's part of what makes us a good person. We want to be happy because we treat other people better when we're happy. And we want other people to be happy, not just because they treat us better, but because we want what's good for other people. So this question of whether or not you can be a good person through education is one of the more complex questions, and what it means. You know, there's the old expression, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And there's a Ben Harper song where he changes the line to, you can give a man an education, but you can't make him think, right? You can give people the tools, but only people can exercise them. Then there's a second part of that, which is what gets called the unity of the virtues. And what that means is, can you be good in one area of your life without being good in the other? Can you be a truthful person without being a just person? Can you be a just person without being a beautiful person, understood largely? Can you be a beautiful person without being, for Aristotle and Plato, a moderate person? Is it possible to be good in one area without being good in all areas? So when we ask happiness, we have to ask not just, can you be happy at work and not happy at life, but rather, can you be a happy person, or can you have a happy society if there isn't justice, if there isn't fairness, if there isn't security, if there isn't commitments to truth and exploration and the human condition. Happiness is embedded in all of those circumstances, and that's part of what makes it so hard.
We're enjoying our monthly Philosophical Currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which is a podcast and a radio show that we air every month here at Prairie Public. Jack, I want to ask you about money and happiness, if we can go there. And then I'm going to ask you about the cultural transfer of happiness as we wrap things up. All right, we all want to be happy. Studies show, though, that the more materialistic we get, the less happy we become. Why is that?
There is a threshold in which the rate of return starts to go down. And here's what that means. you need money to be happy up to a point, right? You need rent, you need food, you need access to, you know, transportation to get to your job, right? You need these basic things. You want to be able to pay for your child's education. You want art on your walls or whatever, right? You need money up to a certain point. But after a certain point, these necessities become conveniences and conveniences become luxuries. And what ends up happening for most people is that once they start acquiring a lot of money, their vision of life becomes acquiring more money. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, an endless cycle of I want more, I want more, I want more. I'll get back to that in just a second. Additionally, it becomes very, very easy when you have a lot of money to be in situations where you can indulge the worst parts of you, or the selfish parts of you. One of my theories about why so many rich people get into so much trouble, why, you know, Woody Allen gets into trouble for doing what he does, and Elon Musk gets into trouble for doing what he does, and Harvey Weinstein, et cetera, is that the richer and more powerful you get, the fewer people you have to say no to you. And no is very, very important, because we all push boundaries. We all try to cross the line. We all, in one way or the other, try to grab the things that we shouldn't have. And when people say no to us, when society says no to us, it is often, not always, but often a form of protection, a form of stopping our self-destruction. When you get a lot of money, and when you have power especially, you have the ability to destroy yourself in ever-increasing ways. And that means that you are going to be in pain, you're going to be in fear, you're going to be indulging the worst parts of you, you're going to be exploiting others. And this goes back to that question of happiness. How does happiness connect to goodness, and what does it mean to be a good person? Money is, my father, when I was growing up, used to say, rich or poor, it's nice to have money. and there's a truth to that. You need money up to a point, but after a certain point, the question isn't whether you have money. The question is, what do you do with it? Now, I want to go back to something I said a minute ago, which is this idea that we compare ourselves to others. There was a very interesting study that I want to track down that I read years ago that was one of my favorite pieces of information. And I might have mentioned it on the show before. There was a study done of African-American soldiers after they came back from World War II. And they assumed that the African-American soldiers in the North would be happier than the African-American soldiers in the South, because their conditions were better in the North and Jim Crow dominated in the South. They actually found the opposite, that the Southern soldiers were happier. Why? Because in the North, the African-American soldiers were at the bottom of the rung. There was no one underneath them. In the South, there was still people underneath the soldiers, and that was African Americans who didn't go to the army, African Americans who were still sharecroppers, African Americans who were still really suffering and were the bottom of the bottom. And what the study argued is that part of what makes us happy is how we compare ourselves to other people. And one of the things that, at least in American culture, because the study wasn't international, in the American culture was, we want to feel better off than some of our neighbors. We want to feel like we're in a better circumstance. When you are rich, you are constantly comparing yourself to the richest person in the world. You're constantly comparing to people who have more. I've seen a slew of articles, I don't know his name, about this person who is always described as the second rich person on earth, underneath Elon Musk. Can you imagine always being described as the second best?
In that context, Jack, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would be happy, but actually, one of the things that we know is that people who win the lottery almost always go bankrupt within the first 5 years. That this sudden influx of money, this sudden influx of ability, most people can't handle. Now imagine you're born and raised in that circumstance. How do you handle it then? Right? I feel like if someone gave me $5 million right now at 55 years old, I'll be 56 in a week. At 55 years old, I have enough self-control that I could handle it. But studies suggest that that's not necessarily the case and that maybe I think too highly of myself. So money is an enabler. It's a tool for success. It's also a drug. And it's also something that we can use to abuse ourselves and others. And abuse, self-abuse, and abuse of others is never, ever on the path to happiness.
Yeah. Money as a drug is an appropriate metaphor, I think. Jack, as we wrap things up, what can the Finnish export to me? Perhaps I don't have control about what our country can consider, but I have control about what I can consider. Can they export anything to me, to us, so that we can be more happy?
One of the things that I loved about the Finnish culture was the speed and the time that people have for reflection and community. And one of the best things about Finland is the sauna experience. Everyone spends time in the sauna regularly. Everyone spends time in the sauna with their friends, regardless of sex or age. And everyone takes the time to be in the sauna. I remember at one point I went to Helsinki and I was coming out of the airport and my friend Johanna, who was taking care of me and who was getting me to places I needed to go, he's talking on the cell phone. And this was the most Finnish experience I'd ever had. I didn't even get to say hello. And he held his hand up for me to stop talking, took the phone away and said, "My wife wants to know if you need me to turn on the sauna." It was the most Finnish moment I've ever had. That experience of being in a place where your body is relaxed, where you're being healthy, but where you're also, you're contemplative, you're focused on your own needs, but you can also be with your community who supports and loves you. And you are naked. The visual differences, the class differences, the labels, the fashion, the working hard to put on your makeup and make your hair do whatever, all that's gone.
Melts
and
away.
What you are human beings, people, individuals, bodies, and minds in an environment where they can be in harmony with yourself and with others. And man, that is an amazing experience that we could all learn from.
Jack, we'll leave it there. Jack Russell Weinstein. We have a monthly segment called Philosophical Currents that we enjoy our discussions with Jack. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and also host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, a radio show that we air monthly here on Prairie Public, and about to have a birthday. Jack, we'll be the first to wish you an early happy birthday next week. Thanks.
Thank you very
so much for joining us on Main Street.
It's always a pleasure. It's one of the highlights of my month. My man is smooth like Barry and his voice got bass. A body like